The Guardian.
Guardian Books is pleased to present listeners of this podcast with a special offer on House of Fun, a bumper collection of Simon Hoggart's 20 years of parliamentary sketch writing.
Labour launched its manifesto yesterday, or rather, it opened a coal hole and poured several tonnes of nutty slag down on the voters.
I am extremely calm,
the Prime Minister replied, but he said it like Herbert Lom as Inspector Clouseau's boss. Caroline Flint is regarded as something of a hard-line toady, an aardvark-tongued bootlicker, a member of an active service unit in the Greaser's provisional wing.
To get your hardback copy of Simon's book for half price, go to guardianbookshop.co.uk/Hoggart and enter the code Hoggart. This offer is for 2 weeks only and is exclusive to this podcast.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. When the government came to power in 2010, the Chancellor said that we're all in it together and that a collective austerity drive would see the deficit wiped out in 5 years. This week, George Osborne said exactly the same thing. After treading fiscal water, there's more austerity and still 5 years needed to wipe out the deficit. So what's gone wrong? And is there any reason to believe him this time around? New cuts in welfare and Whitehall budgets are needed to pay for cuts to corporation tax and a scrapping of planned fuel tax rises. But who are the winners and who are the losers? In this autumn statement special, we'll cut through the missed targets and the fudge figures. And as we sit here in chilly December, even George Osborne's very definition of autumn seems to have slipped. Joining me for all of this, we have the Observer's economics editor, Heather Stewart, The Guardian's economics leader writer, Aditya Chakraborty, and our columnist and regular on the podcast, Martin Kettle. A warm welcome to you all.
2 years ago, Britain was in the danger zone. Now we are seen as one of the safe havens, able to borrow money at lower interest rates than at any time in our history. And today's forecast shows a £33 billion saving on the debt interest payments it was predicted we would have to pay 2 years ago. That is as much as the entire defence budget, which is why, in this autumn statement, we show that this coalition government is confronting the country's problems instead of ducking them. Today, we reaffirm our commitment to reducing the deficit, setting out the details of our spending plans for 2015-16 and rolling forward an outline framework into 2017-18. We show our determination to do this fairly with further savings from bureaucracy, from the benefits bill and from the better off. We go on equipping Britain to succeed in the global race by switching from current spending to capital investment in science, roads and education.
So there it is. George Osborne presented his autumn statement, a mini-budget in all but name, and he was forced to confront a harsh reality. Growth has been revised down again, and only a couple of nimble accounting tricks have allowed the Chancellor to claim that all the pain is reducing the deficit at all. Meanwhile, Britain's coveted AAA rating is under review and analysts are already casting doubt on the Chancellor's assumptions on everything from departmental cuts to recoup tax revenue from serial avoiders. Heather Stewart, for anyone who took George Osborne at his word in 2010, this is a bit of a kick in the teeth, isn't it? Halfway into that 5 years, there's still 5 years to go.
Yes, he extended the period of austerity for another year yesterday in order to meet one of his two fiscal rules. He admitted he'd broken the other one. But he has to balance the budget, the structural budget, adjusted for the state of the economic cycle, over the coming 5 years. Unfortunately, that's a sort of moving target, so 5 years ahead. So he announced some fresh cuts in 2017-18 yesterday, which helped him to meet that target. So, yes, if you're a voter sitting there thinking, you know, Osborne came to power saying it's going to be tough, you know, I'm going to rescue you from a kind of Greek-style death spiral, but you know, stick with me and in 5 years' time we'll be OK. Well, you know, it doesn't quite look the way he had sold it to us.
Martin, when you take a step back and you think a stuck record that keeps saying jam in 5 years is not a very attractive political proposition, but you, like a good deal of Fleet Street today, it has to be said, gave him a relatively kind write-up this morning. Do you think just in narrow party political terms he did the job?
It's obviously a different situation from 2010. The government's strategy has failed. And in that sense, you know, he's very vulnerable. The government is less popular than it was in 2010 by, you know, many points. I think probably he didn't make the government's position any worse politically. I wouldn't put it much more strongly or positively than that.
But is that quite a positive in the circumstances?
I think in the, you know, I think he's sort of held the position. I think that's roughly where I would put it. It seems to me that politically, Osborne and Cameron are attempting to persuade people that, and they use wartime imagery increasingly now, you know, that this is something which we don't want to be in. This is not normal, but we've got to see it through. It's going to go on a long time. You know, the national interest requires. They continue to use the rhetoric of all being in it together. And I think that has a certain resonance. We can say that it's specious, but it also, I think, has a certain resonance. So politically, I think it was a reasonable go, given the bad hand that he had.
With the bad hand he had, there was obviously a big opening for Labour, and there was a bit of a fumble from Ed Balls in his immediate response.
The national deficit is not rising, is rising, it is not falling. The national debt is... I'll say it again. Our economy is contracting this year. Government borrowing and the deficit is revised up this year, next year and every year. And the national debt is rising. It is not falling.
Aditya, did that sound like Labour missing an open goal to you?
I think Ed Balls was patently surprised, palpably surprised at the fact that borrowing was falling, not rising. And he was right to be surprised because, as you alluded to in your introduction, a fair amount of fidgeting and trickery went into those figures. And actually, if you add, you know, if you take away the 4G auction receipts, which suddenly you're all booked this year and they come in exactly £3.5 billion, but if you take away that, then actually borrowing is going up. But I think Ed Balls has consistently actually been slightly wrong-footed by George Osborne. I know that the critique of too far, too fast, which Labour's used against the Conservatives and Lib Dems, has been effective. But actually, George Osborne has, I think, has done about as politically viable an austerity strategy as I can imagine any Chancellor doing. If you're going to have austerity, then the kind of verdict that hangs over any government that's pursuing austerity is the one that was handed down, the prophecy from Mervyn King, which was whoever takes over at the next general election in 2010 is going to be the most unpopular government ever. You know, which actually it struck me that when Osborne took over as Chancellor, that wasn't how he was going to play things at all. Actually, his austerity strategy was quite electorally viable. He went around cutting things which didn't exist. So he went after infrastructure spending rather than cutting current spending. He tried to moralise the cuts he was making. So it was about, you know, shirkers versus strivers and that sort of thing. And actually, that puts Labour consistently in quite a difficult position when you're trying to oppose these cuts. Because, yeah, you can say economically they're mad, but then people come back to you and say, so what would you cut? And actually, if you want to be electable, then you would do the kind of things that Osborne does. And that's why, to, you know, this week, straight after the welfare cuts, Labour left with quite a difficult position. Well, do we oppose these welfare cuts, for instance?
We'll come on to the details of who's won and lost in a minute. But before we do, what's really important, Heather, is that we don't lose sight of the big picture on growth and unemployment and not so much the deficit, but what it will mean for people paying taxes and using services down the line. Did we learn with the Office for Budget Responsibilities reports yesterday, how far did the big picture change?
Certainly their model for estimating what the big picture is seems to have changed, which they've admitted. But certainly when we looked at their forecast in 2010, in June 2010, when Osborne did his emergency budget, as he called it, what the OBR were then expecting was what I suppose you would call a standard recession, you know, or a standard recovery. You know, we'd had a very, very deep downturn, the deepest that anyone could remember. And they were expecting that, you know, just as usually happens after a downturn, you know, business investment would bounce back, consumer spending would bounce back, you know, and the economy would be, look something like normal in 5 years. Now, there were plenty of people out there at the time saying, you know, actually, we're doing deep austerity at a time when it's being done in other countries too. We've got a banking sector that's broken, which, you know, and experience shows that if you've had a financial crisis, you get a much slower recession. But, you know, whether you could have predicted it at the time, it's certainly the case that they were wrong and that we're now looking at, 8 years. So, you know, we can start to call it a kind of Japanese style lost decade, really, of dipping in and out of recession, of very, very slow growth. So, and they're now saying, you know, that this is a very long dip, a kind of long period of what Mervyn King calls it a zigzag. You know, you can call it flatlining, whatever, but it's certainly not a kind of recovery in any strong sense. And if you look below the figures, actually, in terms of what people will feel, you know, real wages, so wages adjusted for inflation, are now not going to start to rise for another 2 or 3 years. You know, so when it comes to whatever people think about the welfare cuts, and perhaps, you know, Osborne may be right that there's strong political support for that, but there'll be a lot of people who maybe don't feel drastically worse off if they've kept their job and the cost of their mortgage has gone down and so on, but don't feel any better off. You know, their house price isn't rising. Their wages have been pretty much flat for quite a long time. So, you know, we're not going to get, Osborne was hoping we might get something like what we used to call the feel-good factor back before 2015, and we're certainly not going to get that.
I mean, it's interesting that the Resolution Foundation only this morning have put out numbers about what wages are going to be towards the end of this decade.
They're saying it'll be even longer, don't they? Yeah.
2017 now, the wages will be the same as they were in 2000. So almost a lost generation, Martin, of economic progress as it's measured in the pay packet. There's never been anything like that watching of politics before, has there?
No, I think we could be entering really quite a long period. Who can say how long? I don't know. But quite a long period, more than just a few years, you know, in which the new normal is that things aren't very, there isn't much growth, that, you know, there aren't sort of magic moments of prosperity. And I think but it feels to me as a got to be taken seriously as a possibility, you know, that the countries like Britain in Northern Europe and elsewhere in the world with a sort of comparable histories are actually going to have less money around than for all than they have been used to in the post-Second World War period. And, you know, that's going to change everything. It's going to change politics, certainly. And, you know, I think in some ways the Tories, because that's what kind of turns them on a bit in some ways, are more adapted to those kind of times than Labour, which is essentially a things can only get better party. And things may not get better, and therefore, you know, awkward choices. I mean, I thought it's interesting that Osborne finished by saying there's no sort of magic wand solution, and the public knows that. And I think he may be right. And if he is right about that, you know, that makes Labour's response to all this quite a difficult call. But, you know, it's all very interesting stuff.
The difficulty you've got there, I think Martin and Heather on something. This will be this looks almost certain. This will be a much more prolonged slump than any we've experienced in decades. But what you've got, I think, since 2010, you've got a division of fatalists, and the coalition become increasingly fatalistic, and so have other policymakers. You know, Bank of England sound increasingly fatalistic. You know, there's only so much we can do, and then that's it, really.
We're now a poorer country.
We're now a poorer country, and get used to it. And then you've got this kind of half-hearted progressivism from Labour, where they say, well, you know, we do things slightly differently, but
cut VAT by 2 points, exactly. It'll be all right.
You do some minor tinkering to the tax code, and things will be slightly less worse than they are under that lot. The thing I found most revealing about the borrowing figures that were put out yesterday were that actually, if you look at them, most of the improvements come from one-off things like a raid on the Bank of England's quantitative easing fund, the auction of the 4G telecoms licences, the raid on the Royal Mail's pension fund. That is not, as one city consultancy said yesterday, that is not a material improvement in public finances. That's simply going around trying to look that round the back of every single sofa you've got, putting all your loose change together and saying, well, there we go, things look a bit better this year. Actually, the economic model that this country's been based on for decades, three decades or so, looks pretty badly broken. And I'm not sure that within the sort of politics as it's configured in this country, you have any sense either of a real recognition of that fact, or let alone a sense of what the alternative might be.
Should we, we shouldn't entirely dismiss before we've discussed the various things that George Osborne spoke up about that he said might benefit growth. So,
there's a big increase in capital
tax,
allowances.
Capital allowance.
Yeah, for, you know, tax breaks for companies wanting to invest. And actually, you know, you need an improvement in business investment. A lot of the business groups have been calling for that. That, you know, that's a perfectly sensible measure. We have incredibly low levels of investment, you know, relative
country,
to GDP
yeah.
in this country, yeah. And we have had for a long time. And actually, you know, if you're trying to kind of improve the productivity of your economy, and if you want to achieve some kind of rebalancing, as it's called, you know, towards exports, you need companies to invest. So that's not mad. The cut in corporation tax seemed politically odd to me at a time when there's been huge public fury about large companies paying very, very little. And I know they make an argument that you cut corporation tax and you get the rate as low as possible, and then, you know, yippee, these firms come and base themselves here. But given that we can't charge Dublin, indeed. And given that we don't seem to be able to charge them any money even when they are based here, that seems like a bit of a weak argument.
Is it a bit like saying you could increase the dole so people didn't have to do a job on the side?
Yes, that's the idea, is make the rate lower and there'll be an incentive for companies to go legit, as it were. But you know, our corporation tax rate already is
relatively
low.
They're two sides of the same coin, aren't they? I mean,
yeah.
In this country, we've got the British disease in which the police classes don't actually invest very much. And it's been going on for decades now. And that's actually one of the harsh realities we have to get used to. Actually, it's not necessarily workers who are lazy in this country. It's bosses that are lazy, I think.
Martin, do you think that people are, you know, middle Britain is very angry about companies dodging their tax, aren't they, in a way that they weren't 10 years ago. Do you think that cutting corporation tax, you know, cutting the tax of big companies could be as unpopular as cutting tax for rich individuals was at the time of the March budget? Or is it just seen as a different sort of thing?
I think it's different. But it is, I think one thing that's important about it is that it's an issue that divides the two coalition parties. I mean, Vince Cable has been a fairly strong opponent of these lower and lower corporation taxes. And he's made quite a philosophical case, you know, a case with which I happen to agree, about the need for individual taxation and corporate taxation to be more aligned, and to say that incentives and so on and responsibility are equally shared between the corporate and the individual. So, you know, he will not have enjoyed listening to that. I mean, that was Osborne playing to the gallery. But I think it's not the issue on which the worm is going to turn for Middle Britain, and, you know, people are going to take to the streets and say, enough is enough. I think that realistically, I think the alienation of Middle Britain from some aspects of corporatism is going to take the form of quite local campaigns about, you know, Starbucks and Tesco's and you know, don't use Amazon to buy your Christmas presents and that sort of thing.
So it's their problem,
rather than a sort of macro political thing.
Okay, let's turn now to so those companies are gaining, but let's turn to the households who are gaining and losing. There was a prolonged freeze now at the petrol pumps, and there was also a big squeeze on benefits, as has been importantly pointed out today, not just for workless but also for working households, going for many, many years ahead. Martin, in the Guardian editorial today, we called it white van conservatism. Does it look like Thatcherism revisited to you, or is it more subtle?
Well, it's certainly recognisable from Thatcherism. I think what I would say that in the trajectory of the coalition, the interesting thing is that perhaps it's a little less kind of idealistic and driven and more pragmatic. There are sort of bits of pragmatism in the package yesterday, it seems to me, like, I mean, a 1% increase is, you know, in real terms is still a cut, but it's still, you know, it's a slightly more conciliatory kind of move than would have been made in 2010, when it was countries faced with crisis, we have to clamp down, you know, you think back to that moment when George Osborne and David Laws stood in front of the Treasury and kind of sang this passionate duet about, we're going to have to cut everything now, and this is good, and Britain will be better off for it. That's not the mood at all now. It's, you know, a bit here, a bit there. There isn't much to go round, you know, something for them, even with the exception, of course, of the pensioners who remain in this sort of serenely almost untouched moment because they're the people who vote Conservative.
But I don't think we should lose sight of how deep those welfare cuts are,
though. I agree. My point is that it's on the margins.
I'm sure will say they've fought off something far worse, but it does raise nearly £4 billion a year, quite a bit of which has been given back to motorists and to big corporations. So,
because it's 3 years, you're tripping it up, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And there is an argument that it's quite a big moment because for, you know, three decades-ish, we've accepted the principle that the living standards of those people, you know, on welfare, on benefits, should rise at least in line with prices so that they shouldn't see their living standards fall over time. And you know, this is a kind of delinking of that. And I know they've said it only lasts 3 years, but if they are passing legislation, and if you know, 3 years is long enough in politics for something to become the norm. So Labour, depending on where it puts itself, may find itself having to make a great big political argument if it wants to relink benefits to prices again, and you know, this could become the new normal.
I think you're right, Heather, on the economic impact of welfare cuts, but I think Martin's right on the political economy point, which is that one of the basic rules of political economy is that you don't go around making enemies of well-defined vocal groups. If you look back to the March Omnishambles, where
pasty eaters,
pasty eaters, grannies,
caravanners,
you know, George Osborne versus Nick Heitner and the charity and arts lobby.
Yes, they've very much tried not to make that mistake
again. He completely messed that up. So what he's done now is he's immiserating a whole bunch of people by a little
spreading
bit
it thin.
At a time.
That's true.
And certainly, I'd be surprised also if they went after public sector workers in the same way that he did in 2010 too. I think they've learned that lesson, and it's all, you know, we've got to muddle through this rather than we are going to make this country cleaner and better.
And yet it was a part of their story to the likes of us and the chattering classes, if you like, that that they were going to be fair, that they were going to spread the pain fairly. We don't know yet. We haven't seen what the Institute for Fiscal Studies have come up with. But the early analysis done by the Resolution Foundation says that the poor are paying much more.
So does the Treasury's own analysis, to be fair. The Treasury's own distributional analysis, shows that shows
people at the bottom.
So that's what the Cameronians used to call the aroma that they wanted to infuse the Conservative Party with. It's not smelling the same anymore, is it, Alicia?
But it's also moved Labour too, hasn't it? I mean, it's quite a kind of depressing indictment in a way of a party of the left that it doesn't feel, you know, that Ed Balls was kind of felt he had desperately had to avoid the elephant trap of standing up and saying times are incredibly hard and you are making life more difficult for some of the poorest people in this country, you know, and Osborne, you should be ashamed of doing that. We now have a Labour Party that feels that it can't do that, and I understand why, and it's to do with straightened times and whatever, but there must be people in Labour who think, Christ, I went into politics in order to try and make the lives of the poorest people in society better, and you know, we're now in a boxed into a political position where we can't make that argument.
Well, the Red Bull this morning sounded a bit more robust than I'd expected on welfare. Did you hear him, Aditya? He sort of said we need to subject this mini budget to a child poverty test, to a does it help working families, and questions that I suspect he already knows the answer to, which is no.
Well, it will raise child poverty, surely, won't it? I mean, I can't see how it doesn't.
I agree with that, but I also think it strikes me as quite dismaying, actually, that one of the arguments against the cut in benefits is, oh, well, look how many, you know, working families will be affected by this. Because I think actually
case,
the state is subsidising employers to pay their employees less. And that's wrong. And that shouldn't happen. And that's another sort of flaw in Labour thinking I just can't approve of. This kind of reflexive welfareism where you say, well, instead of actually us sort of, you know, doing battle with employees, saying pay your workers more, we'll get the state to subsidise, you know, low wage labour. That's not right.
Well, they are trying to get at that, aren't they, with some of this rhetoric about pre-distribution, although it's not really clear what levers they're going to pull to try and bring that about.
The trouble is, Martin, no one really knows how to do it, isn't it?
I think that's the government's great strength, is that it's not that Labour is, you know, morally awful by the in its failure to produce an alternative. It's that nobody has articulated a clear and sustainable and politically credible serious alternative. So, you know, the arguments are on the margins. The arguments are in small things, not on big things. I mean, you know, Labour's got a problem. It's got all these working class constituencies. It needs to win some middle class ones, which it lost in 2010. To appeal to the voters in those constituencies, it may be enough simply to say that the Tories have punished the poor and this is unacceptable and so on and so forth, and the benefits system is being raided immorally. That may work if the government is unpopular enough, but if it's a more even argument, if it's a more balanced, you know, if the argument is more closely contested, that's quite a daring thing for Labour to do if it's trying to win, you know, the old Worcester woman and the and all the other you know, all the Swindon other cliches that we bring out at election time, because those are the people at the moment who are just sort of hunkered down and hoping things are going to get better at some point.
Although, you know, that's only one strand of an argument, that you're hitting the poorest in order to fix the economy and you failed to fix the economy. I mean, that's the other part of the argument, yeah, isn't it?
It's hurting, you know, but it isn't working.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
And that's why Labour is ahead in the polls, of course. I mean, we shouldn't forget in all this sort of gloom and doom about, you know, what Labour can actually do. That, I mean, you look at the polls, and at the moment, Labour's doing fairly well.
Yeah,
and
but you how look solid at, you do you think that lead is, Martin?
Well, I think it, you know, it's gone up a little bit recently. I mean, the most recent polls, you know, 13, 14% Labour lead. That's not great. It doesn't mean Labour's going to win the next general election, I don't think. But it could, it looks to me as though, you know, Labour could end up now as the largest single party in a hung parliament, I would say. So, you know, it's not bad for Labour.
And then, just to bring back the gloom, because I was worried about the sunlit uplands for the left creeping in there. Aditya, Osborne's favourite line, one of George Osborne's favourite lines, is, of course, talking about his inheritance, how bad that was. But looking at those figures yesterday, whether it's a Labour government or a Conservative government next time, it's not going to be just this Chancellor, but the next Chancellor who's got to blame his predecessor, isn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, the big event, I think, that will shape what the election looks like will be the spending review of next year, which Osborne announced would happen in his autumn statement. So it's now confirmed that the next year there will be a spending review, which sets out the spending priorities for effectively the coalition parties going into the general election.
Is it for 3 years or just for one, do you know?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's 3 years. Otherwise, it's just a budget. I think Labour will have a very difficult job to try and sort of work out what their alternative is to that. But that is only the budgeting side of the picture. There is also then a general question about the economic model. And again, there is no real answer there about, well, what should we do to make the country a bit different, or how do we get growth, all the rest of it. If you looked at the growth strategy, Heather's right. There were capital allowances for small businesses to go and do a bit more sort of investment in themselves and their workers. But I don't really see that as being a growth strategy. And I certainly don't see talking warmly about India and China as being a growth strategy. And so I wonder, you know, the Eurozone crisis drags on. China keeps on slowing down. America sort of picks up a bit and has 2% growth for the next couple of years. What are the prospects for Britain in that?
Well, Heather, let's just turn to what could have been the big announcement in the autumn statement yesterday, had the Chancellor not chosen to wheel it out a week or so in advance, which is the new man at the Bank of England, Mark Carney, for whom he got a claim from the City for poaching this brainy Canadian.
Aditya's rather very a high price, it has to be said, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah, is that right? Mervyn King, yeah. Over £100,000 more each year for Mervyn King than for Mervyn King, plus relocation.
Plus pension.
Amazing.
But if you can get some growth, it would be worth it, Heather? I mean, Dietrich's despairing about fiscal policy. Any chance that the bank might ride the rescue by doing some imaginative things?
There's not a lot more that they can do without bringing the Treasury on board with anything that they chose to do. So we've already had the funding for lending scheme, you know, under which we provide cheap loans to banks, you know.
And they provide cheap mortgages to people who've already got the big deposits.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, it's slightly brought down the borrowing cost for people who would have been able to borrow anyway.
It
doesn't seem to have done very much at all to unlock business lending, which is, it's agreed, is the main problem. So, I mean, the Bank of England, to a large extent, Mervyn King insists they haven't run out of ammunition, but, you know, they've been incredibly aggressive. They've cut rates to a record low. They've done a massive amount of quantitative easing. There's not a great deal more they can do. And really, you know, getting to grips with the state of the banking sector, the financial sector, you know, is a the bank keeps sounding warnings about the fact that banking sector needs to be strengthened and there isn't enough lending going on and there's a kind of credit freeze. But it hasn't really got the weapons to do anything about it. So, I mean, Carney's, and in fact, there's plenty of economists now who are saying, actually, is targeting inflation really the right thing to do? There's a growing argument about, you know, whether the framework itself is bust. So
could they change that very quickly?
They could change it, but it would need a radical rethink, and it certainly won't be up to Mr. Carney. So he may be, you know, absolutely brilliant, but I don't think he's a miracle worker. I don't think he's got a magic wand either, if George Osborne hasn't.
Oh dear. Well, before economic depression gives rise to the psychological variety, I think we'd better draw things to a close. So my thanks to the panel, Aditya Chakraborty, Heather Stewart and Martin Kettle. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Guardian Books is pleased to present listeners of this podcast with a special offer on House of Fun, a bumper collection of Simon Hoggart's 20 years of parliamentary sketch writing.
Labour launched its manifesto yesterday, or rather, it opened a coal hole and poured several tons of nutty slag down on the voters.
I am extremely calm, the Prime Minister replied, but he said it like Herbert Lom as Inspector Clouseau's boss. Caroline Flint is regarded as something of a hard-line toady, an aardvark-tongued bootlicker, a member of an active service unit in the Greaser's provisional wing.
To get your hardback copy of Simon's book for half price, go to guardianbookshop.co.uk/Hoggart and enter the code Hoggart. This offer is for 2 weeks only and is exclusive to this podcast.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.